Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our holiday gifts to all of you. We do every year. We've been doing, as I said, on our other programs for the last 17 years now. And for many of those years, one of my dear friends has come in every year to play some beautiful pieces for this holiday season now, for this year, between Christmas and New Year's. And Jonathan Carney, who is concertmaster of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, which means he's playing the fiddle, the first violinist. And Jonathan, welcome. Good to have you on
the air. Thank you, Mark. Thank you. It's great to be here, as always.
Having good holidays?
So far, so good. We've just finished our holiday shows at the Meyerhof, and they were a big success. It's been a tradition now for 5 years and always going very well. It's, totally different music to what we're going to hear today. It's very light and topical and Christmassy. Most of the music today is not going to be like that.
Well, what do you have in store? This is an interesting mix that you're picking for our listeners to kind of enjoy and play with. And I remember the last time we were on here, we were talking with Yasha Heifetz, right?
Yes, indeed.
And we had this debate. There was a debate that grew up in my house. My parents always argued who was the greatest violinist from their time.
Ah.
And my mother was Heifetz.
Yes, well, your mother and millions of others. She was in good company. She was in good company. At that time, you could argue, Heifetz was born, well, there's some debate about that, but in the year 1900 for the most part. So in the 20s and 30s, you still had the great violinist Kreisler, who was on the, later part of his career. He was the greatest violinist, certainly before Heifetz, and arguably even during Heifetz's life. You had Misha Elman, but all these were – it was kind of a different school of violin playing back then. Heifetz came along and radically changed.
How so?
To get specific, the violin players were very lyrical in the later half of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century. Lots of slides and portamenti, and it was very syrupy, for lack of a better word.
So what does portamenti mean?
Well, that's when you slide a lot of the instrument, and everything sort of gets has a liaison between it. Whereas Heifetz sort of cleaned up violin playing in certain regard. Technically, he was beyond reproach, and composers, of course, wrote more concertos for him than any other violinist in history. He commissioned so many works. One of which we're going to be listening to, not the actual work, but the composer, Eric Korngold. But any composer of note at that point was desperate to have Heifetz play the concertos. And he pushed the envelope really quite far. And the whole sort of nature of violin playing changed after Heifetz. And there's a famous story of Heifetz playing his debut at Carnegie Hall when he was just a boy. And Kreisler was in the audience with a pianist friend of his. And Kreisler had turned to his friend after hearing the first couple works of Heifetz and saying, it's getting rather warm in here, isn't it? And he said, not for pianists. So it certainly changed the whole map of violin playing. And he's regarded as the first sort of real modern violinist. Although today there's a great movement to search for that sound that the violinists Francis Scotti and Elman and Kreisler had sort of developed, and getting a little bit more lyrical. Musical tastes have an ebb and flow like anything else, and I would say we're sort of returning to that time a little bit, and I certainly look for that in my playing as well. But that's not to say Heifetz wasn't incredibly lyrical in his playing. It was a much more visceral style of violin playing, and he really grabbed you by the shirt collar and thrust the music through the voice of the violin in your face.
I think the other violinist in my house, my dad's, was Yehudi Menuhin.
Oh, of course.
So they had the Menuhin Heifetz battle.
Yes.
Constantly.
Well, Menuhin was the people's violinist in a lot of ways. He, of course, being such a gentle, nurturing soul, and me, I was so lucky in my career to have a long opportunity to work with him in London. There was not a more poetic player or musician around. Heifetz was a little bit more direct in his approach, you could say musically opinionated, whereas Menuhin was much more welcoming of all thoughts. He was big into Eastern philosophy and would play a lot of jazz with some violinists. But, often Heifetz gets shortchanged for his rather stern exterior. But for any people who had ever watched any of those collaborations with Jack Benny in the 30s and 40s and 50s, he was hilarious. He was a funny man, great sense of humor, and really enjoyed working with people of that caliber.
So what are we going to hear from Heifetz?
Well, so, of course, Heifetz recorded just about everything ever written. And there are some works that are certainly more his than others. And I'm playing today a concerto by Max Bruch, the D minor concerto, not to be confused with the G minor. Max Bruch, of course, was often regarded as a one-hit wonder with his famous G minor piano violin concerto, which everybody knows and loves. But he wrote four concertos, all of which were fantastically beautiful. And Heifetz recorded them all. And this one, the second one, is hardly ever played. And as our devotees of the symphony know, I often try to bring standard works that are sort of less well-known, less played, to the Meyerhof. And I had played the G minor only a couple of years ago, but I've been desperate to play the D minor as soon as possible. So this year we're doing it in April. If you like what you hear in the next few minutes, then maybe you'll make a visit to the Meyerhof in April and listen to the whole thing. I can't, of course, play it anything like Heifetz, but
don't underestimate yourself, Jonathan.
That sound and again, the sort of passion that he can bring to music like this is unparalleled by any other violinist. So why don't we listen to a little bit of that first movement?
Heifetz.
Mm-hmm. That sound is undeniably the most single most recognized violin sound in the world. You know, there's today you listen to many of today's violinists, and it's really hard to identify who that might be. It could be Josh Bell, it could be Victoria Mileva, it could be a handful of great violinists, all great. But that unique sound that Heifetz had, it's instantly recognizable, and today we've sort of lost that voice that performers had back then.
You seem to have it. Others seem to have it. I mean,
yeah, perhaps so. I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to quantify that. You know, the how people listen to artists like that. But I just think the type of sound, the type of violin playing, it's you'll never ever hear right. anything like that again. You know, he is absolutely unique.
So Brahms.
Brahms, yes. We, you know, nice little segue from Brooke to Brahms. They were, of course, sort of colleagues and rivals at that time. And Brooke, of course, lived in the shadow of having composed this wonderful first violin concerto. And then no one ever really took many of his other works seriously. Whereas Brahms, you know, he struggled early on to find an identity and a compositional voice. But, you know, what can I say? Brahms is Brahms. If I had to go to my desert island with one disc, it would probably be the music of Brahms. You sort of really? One composer, absolutely. The four symphonies he wrote are beyond question as the greatest symphonies ever written, I think. But his third symphony, there's a particular movement in that, the intermezzo, the poco allegretto movement, which is so tender, so beautiful. Used by composers for film scores, by directors for film scores. And also, years ago, I came across a recording of some music of Carlos Santana, who had used it in one of his jazz tracks. It's so beautiful and very evocative. And you can see when we listen to it how perfectly suited it is for some type of intermezzo love scene. In a movie. So there's a few things today that we're playing that are sort of revolving around that love motif. Maybe it's just my age, but, you know, I just looked at so many of our things and realized, yeah, there's a lot of lovey stuff today.
Well, but, you have a life that leads to that, don't you?
Yeah, for the most part, yes.
Your music, I'm very your
lucky.
Family.
That's right. I'm very lucky. So there's no reason why that shouldn't be first in my mind, foremost in my mind.
Let's have a little Brahms, Third Symphony. I was thinking about Brahms. We were listening to this, and it's little did he know there was no film when he wrote.
Absolutely,
in the late 19th century, right?
Yeah,
in the late 19th century, and he really. I was just thinking about it as you were describing it. He really did begin this romantic period of music we call classical music that came out of. He loved the great German composers of Bach, Beethoven, but he did something twisted. In a way, I never realized how powerful he was in terms of changing the nature of what we call classical music.
Absolutely. I mean, he certainly followed in that Germanic tradition And many regard his First Symphony as Beethoven's 10th Symphony. You know, it was definitely a direct descendant of that style. But Brahms, you know, we often, there's a little musical adage that we often joke about that Brahms and Tchaikovsky were, of course, contemporaries, and Brahms was able to do so much with so little, and Tchaikovsky, whilst Tchaikovsky did so little with so much. Brahms struggled always when he wrote, and it never came easily to him, but he could write a melody as exquisitely beautiful as anybody. But, you know, you often come out of a concert having heard music of Brahms, and you can't think of any particular tunes that stick in your head. It's not, he's not that sort of composer. He wove the whole package together so beautifully. It was very evocative music. And I think, you know, many of our composers today who did exist during the film era always turned to film at some point in their career to sort of just relieve a certain part of their character, of their personality.
I hadn't thought about that. And we'll jump to our next piece here, Romeo and Juliet, while we have time, and we'll explain that to you. But one of the things that I've come to realize is that, you know, listen, you have satellite radio, at least I do in my car, right? So, and one of the channels on there is Cinemagic.
Mm.
And so every once in a while, I'm on the classical channel, and two down from there is this Cinemagic, and I'll just, what are they playing? And I'll listen to it as I'm driving, and what strikes me is I never, you never think of cinematic music as being really wonderful music, but it is.
That's right. It is wonderfully. It sort of encompasses all of human range of human emotion, and it's as incidental music. It really aids the listening and the pleasure of music. It sort of gives you a more two-dimensional a view. So, yes, I turn on the movie channels as often as possible. And we'll listen to all the old scores. But
so what's happening under us here? Is this Romeo and Juliet?
Yes, it's Romeo and Juliet. And this is not Tchaikovsky's, which is perhaps the more famous, but Prokofiev. Other composers took Romeo and Juliet, the story, and composed around it. Prokofiev's perhaps is the most dramatic, as we can hear now. This is the very opening of the work, and it soon goes into what is the sort of allegro section of the Montagues and Capulets. This is the introduction of the two families through Prokofiev's eyes. And this, of course, many ballet composers, Baryshnikov choreographers, had worked with this piece, and it works beautifully for that. But Prokofiev was also an avid film composer, and had he perhaps not been imprisoned, within the Soviet regime, he might have had more opportunity to delve into that.
And this piece that we're listening to now, we'll listen to it just like 10 seconds, is from for a ballet that he did in 1905. Is
that's
that right?
That's right. Right. That's right.
Here we go. I love that.
Drama at its greatest.
And it fits because, the Romeo and Juliet period, whether it was the update from West Side Story that Bernstein did, that story and that music is actually something I've used as theater pieces between communities in conflict, because that's Romeo and Juliet.
That's it. You know? In a nutshell. That's right. That's right. And the drama that's evoked by this work is so huge. You can see why Prokofiev, Stravinsky, composers like that at that time were so sought after by ballet companies, because their music could depict the drama that sometimes can be lost with dancers. You need that music to really reinforce what's happening in the ballet at the time.
And when you hear Prokofiev and others, Shostakovich, you can hear that Russian sound.
Oh yes.
I mean it's a specific kind of peculiar, not peculiar in an odd way, but a particular to the culture.
That's right.
Of Russia.
Absolutely.
And our former maestro.
Nobody did Prokofiev like Temirkanov. It was in his blood, of course. But having said that, we're recording all the Prokofiev symphonies with the Baltimore Symphony this year with Marin.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's going to be an exciting project.
So you're going to record them with the live audience?
Live audience, as we've done for the last few years now. Our projects have always been live performances, which we have three or four performances that we use for that. But it's a wonderful way to record. And some of those Prokofiev symphonies are rarely done, so it's going to be a great opportunity for both listener and musician alike.
So you're bringing people in for those? Just you and Marin the symphony? Or?
Yep, Marin will be doing all seven of the symphonies. I'm not sure the plans to record all seven, how long they'll take, but it will take a few years to get that way. But we're certainly starting with the first symphony this year, the Classical Symphony, which is the most lighthearted and Haydn-esque of any of his work.
Now, the next piece we're about to hear, Mahler.
Yes, Mahler.
We'll hear a little bit of my coming up under us as we're talking here in a moment. But
more love music.
More love music. Is it true that Mahler is the most difficult of the composers for you all to play in orchestras, the most complex or one of the most complex?
Yes, you're absolutely right. More so than he is more difficult to play, it's difficult for the conductor to interpret often Mahler. You know, he was very specific and very detailed in his directions to the orchestra, but almost to a fault, where it became difficult to know exactly what he wanted because you were receiving so many directions. But the movement that we're listening to now, the Adagietto from the Fifth Symphony, is one of his most sublime movements. And again, used by film composers, used by directors, most notably in Death in Venice some years ago. And it was a love letter, a musical love letter from Mahler to his soon-to-be wife, Alma. His way of expressing himself in music, and it is one of the most beautiful things, and I think instantly recognizable melodies in classical music.
Let's enjoy this for a few minutes. I love Mahler.
Yes, it's very soothing.
It's soothing, and also one of the things I think about Mahler as we listen to this and going to break here is that I always feel when I listen to Mahler, there's also soothing, but there's pain in this piece.
Oh, yes.
For me, this is a guy who was a brilliant composer, forced to become Catholic because they hated Jews and wouldn't let him really play and compose. So he had to kind of become a Catholic to make it happen in Austria. And he was, and I always feel that kind of sense of that in his music.
Absolutely. Tortured soul. And we did an interesting program this year with Mahler had met and had one appointment with Sigmund Freud. It lasted for about 4 hours. And they were both on holiday in the same resort town in Holland. And not that many details came out, but there were a few letters. And it's been it must have been a fascinating meeting to be a fly on the wall listening to those two talk for 4 hours about life, love, music, and everything in between. Yes, he was a tortured soul, and you hear that all the time in his music.
Jonathan Carney is with us, one of our holiday gifts to you. Of course, he's the concertmaster for the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra and joins us every year with his music for this holiday season. We're going to let Mahler take us into this break, and we'll come right back with Jonathan Carney, so don't go away. Enjoy. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with a dear friend, Jonathan Carney, who is concertmaster of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, and every year he comes by to bring some holiday favorites of his to favorite pieces of his during this holiday season. It's our holiday gift to you as we celebrate this week. Hope all of you, or most of you, are off and relaxing with family and enjoying, and this is what we're doing ourselves. And Jonathan, what's under us?
Well, I was feeling guilty about not having too much festive music, so we decided one of my favorite composers, Vaughan Williams, this is his Fantasia on Green Sleeves, and as you can tell, it's that time of year for music like this. I suppose one of the reasons I love Vaughan Williams so much is having spent so many years in England. Vaughan Williams, of course, is the prodigal son of England, and he certainly we were playing so much of his music weekly there, and that's one sad thing about being in the States in that way. We don't play much English music, we don't play that much Elgar, we don't play that much Walton, we don't play that much Vaughan Williams, and it's a great shame because they're just wonderful composers, and the British style of composition is so different, and melody is so important. And they were all rather conservative in the fact that they weren't sort of in the forefront of their writing in the 20th century, but they're just very English. That's all I can say.
Let's get very English for a moment and listen to a bit of Vaughan Williams and Greensleeves.
Thank you.
You know, Vaughan Williams, you talked about the English sound. And there is, I never thought there is an English sound, though.
Absolutely.
And because some of it's 20th century music.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, it's written, I mean, Vaughan Williams lived in the first half of the 20th century. So it should be, you know, considered modern, if not even avant-garde at times. But very few English composers really achieved that in the first half of the 20th century. Benjamin Britten was perhaps
right.
The most avant-garde, and that came a little bit later.
I love Britten.
Oh, yes. But, but you know, Vaughan Williams, just having, you know, lived there for so long, and one of my favorite works is The Lark Ascending, which is perhaps one of his more famous works. It's such a wonderful work that I have recorded and played over the years so many times. So Vaughan Williams has a very special place in my heart.
And he did a lot of music scores for movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
He did lots of movies.
Absolutely. He loved it. You know, again, and a great vehicle for him to sort of be able to get out his expression. He was a very emotional, very sentimental man.
And it's the thing that strikes me also about this is that he wrote so many pieces that premiered in America. Yet, that as you said, the orchestras aren't playing them.
No, I know. It's a good shame. He's fallen out of fashion, like many composers do. But I've always tried at the BSO to bring some of that Britishness back into the repertoire. Next year we'll do some Elgar. This year we are playing Walton First Symphony, which is a fantastic symphony. That's going to be very exciting with Carlos Kalmar later in the season. So if you need a British fix, then come to that.
I always need a British fix. So my mom was a Brit. I always need a British fix.
Of course.
So what is this?
Ah, yes, I've heard it and right away remember why I brought it. Astor Piazzolla. Piazzolla's a composer I've been trying to champion as much as possible recently. It was sort of rediscovered by Gidon Kremer maybe 10 years ago or so. He was an Argentine tango composer, not a classical composer by any means. And he was, perhaps is, the most famous composer to come out of South America in many regards now. He wrote tangos almost exclusively. He had a state-sponsored tango orchestra, which traveled around the world in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and then sort of fell out of fashion. Of course, his tango groups were much smaller. These have been arranged for string orchestra and symphony orchestra, and these are what we're listening to right now is Gidon Kremer playing one of the Piazzolla Seasons, which were meant to be coupled with Vivaldi's Seasons. And so I've been programming them, and I'll be doing it again later this year in Frederick, called the Eight Seasons, where we intersperse Vivaldi, Piazzolla, Vivaldi, Piazzolla, eight times. And they're very complementary works.
Is this with your chamber group you're going to do this?
Yes, with the BSO.
With the BSO.
Yes, and they're very complementary. They always have fast beginning sections, and then what we're listening to now is the very beautiful slow section.
Here we go. Piazzolla. Thank you. piazzolla. You can hear the tango, can't you?
Absolutely, I can see the rose emerging from your teeth right now as we speak.
He's like, I have rose in my teeth. That'd be good.
Yeah, it's a totally different oral soundscape. The music of Piazzolla, and that's why it's so engaging. I think as a performer, you're given much more license to improvise and come up with not just notes but sounds that are not used by other composers.
Yeah, that's something I think when people who love classical music but don't necessarily know a lot about it or go to the symphony very much, is what you just said is something that people I don't think associate with classical music. Which is the idea that you take a composer's work, the notes that he or she has written, and you can improvise in terms of how you play those notes.
That's right. That's right. Of course, that being that one of the oldest methods of performance from the Baroque era, you were not just encouraged; you had to improvise in order to make the work sort of happen on stage, on a live performance. That got lost for many, many years as composers got much more particular and exacting about what they wanted to hear from their piece. But now that's coming back into fashion, and more players who are being trained in the conservatories now are learning how to compose and how to engage music in a more upfront sort of way.
And now?
Well, now I thought we'd go back to our sort of movie theme a little bit and do perhaps one of the most famous classical / movie composers, Eric Korngold. Now, a few years ago, people will remember me doing the Korngold Violin Concerto, which was, as I said earlier, commissioned by and performed by Heifetz. Now, Korngold sort of brings all sorts of things into mind. We think of Errol Flynn and Robin Hood, Captain Blood, the Seahawk, Seawolf. Some of the more interesting movies of the 30s and 40s that he did. And I think often you'll say, you know, he was the composer of Robin Hood, and everyone will say, right, I recognize that. But if you said the Violin Concerto you played, they wouldn't know anything about it. But he was a hugely gifted protege and had studied with Strauss and was writing when he was as young as Mozart, when he was 9, 10, 11, writing full symphonies, operas, all sorts of things. But he was enticed to Hollywood in the 20s and really then focused his career purely on film scores, which in a way is a shame. But he's a wonderfully gifted orchestral colorist and musician.
I always think of Korngold as someone who, if he had not been enticed to the commercial side and brought here, he could have died in the camps.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. I mean, it was a saving grace coming here, not just, his life, but I think musically it gave him a direction that he really needed.
So what are we listening to?
We're listening to a couple movements from the Adventures of Robin Hood. That was the main title, and now we're
the Errol Flynn, the original 1938 movie.
Oh, yes. I think this is the Banquet in the Castle.
Let's hear a bit of Robin Hood. Swashbuckle time. He won an Academy Award for his Robin Hood track.
That's right. Oh yes, he was the most sought after Hollywood composer of the time. But these days, I'm kind of getting into playing music by composers who were, we might say, crossover, for the lack of a better word. Rozsa, Miklós Rozsa, composer from of Ben-Hur, and Korngold and Waxman. And there's so many great composers of that time. And there's such an identifiable sound with that music of that time. And again, I think it just harks back to earlier days when music and composers really had a unique voice.
And when you listen to film scores, I mean, there's something about this. They all seem to have, not all, but many, this kind of lush, huge violin section.
That's right.
Just, you know, violins for days.
Yeah, you're so right about that, because, you know, composers like that knew how to orchestrate. They were trained so wonderfully in the art of orchestration, which is how to get a soundscape there with musicians. Hollywood had seen endless budget. They would have orchestras of 100, 120 people on stage. They'd have 40 violins on stage. And the funny thing is, so many of them were Eastern Europeans, either just immigrants or refugees, as the case may be. And so that sound, you know, that Eastern European sound is so different in how to play a string instrument at that time. And they really brought that. And we're still benefiting from that within the profession, from the teachers of or students of those teachers who are teaching the kids these days. You still get some of that old-fashioned sound. Nothing like it.
Nothing like it. No, it's amazing. And, it's funny. As I said, it's only been recently that I've come once again to appreciate film scores as great music.
Yeah, absolutely. And this comes – and I have a great two-disc set here called The Warner Brothers Years of the music of Korngold. And it's got all of his great film scores. So if you want to go out there and look for it, it's a wonderful double CD to have. But if you're wanting to listen to something a little bit more classical, then please get his violin concerto. That's one of his greatest, more classical works. But it's still full of themes from his film scores. He could never get away from it. So you'll still get that feeling that if it's not actually written for a film, bits of it will bring up memories of various films.
Now we're going to move from film scores to a little family music.
Yeah, a little family music. Yeah. I can't help but want to play a movement of a CD that my mother and I had made some years ago in England. And it was made in 1995, but it only just got released last year.
That's you.
That's me and my mom, who is now 87. And when she was recorded, she was in her mid-70s, and she's a phenomenally gifted pianist who also studied at Juilliard in the 30s and 40s and was quite a protege at the time. And
you went to Juilliard?
Yes, I did as well.
Yes, right.
But I was quite anxious to make sure that we had something down on CD with the two of us.
Because so what
she
are you playing?
Played with me
what
my
is,
whole
what
life.
Is this? What is this?
This is music of Chrysler. It's called La Gitana.
Let's hear a little bit of this. We'll come back and talk more about it.
Thank you.
I'm glad you... I remember when you first brought this to the studios with me. It was a few years ago when you found this piece you did with your mom, and you were working on it. And
that's right.
And we played it. It hadn't been played anywhere yet.
No. It hadn't been played anywhere. Now it's been out on the market for a couple of years now, and it's all music of Sarasota and Chrysler, and there's 15, 16 tracks on it. And I just wanted something to have for my grandchildren and
for posterity, for your family, you and your mother.
You know, because she didn't do a lot of recording. She sort of decided to go the family route and not really perform. But she was all of our pianists through our childhood years and performing years. We did all of our recitals, all of our concerts with mom, but we didn't really have anything down on recording. So this has made her very happy, and all the kids and the grandkids now, and it's nice to have something.
How many of you are violinists in your family?
There's four. In my immediate family, and my youngest daughter is also playing now, so we're carrying on the tradition. My dad was also a musician, so it's, you know, we all went to the Juilliard School, so there's a very long line of it. And my son's also a very talented trumpet player, and
he is going into
composing. He wants to be a composer, so maybe one day we'll be sitting in this room playing some of his music.
I hope so, and we'll be listening to some of her music when she becomes this violinist I know she's going to become.
We'll see. That's my next pet project at some point, not obviously in the next few years because she's only 13, but sometime in the next dozen or so years, I'd like to get some of some music of Bach and things like that down on recording with her.
Yes, she is. Yeah. Yeah. And you'll be playing together with some friends on New Year's Eve?
Yes, hopefully. We'll be doing that. And a little chamber music soiree at a friend's house.
Yeah.
And hopefully I'll be bringing Gracie to a little benefit concert we do up at St. John's in Butler. In August as well. So we're she's getting to an age now where she needs to be playing more and is able to
a wonderful kid.
Do that. So
we'll have to bring Maisie up to hear that.
Oh, indeed.
So what are we closing with here?
Well, I thought we would play, we've been talking so much about film music, but one of the more modern film composers that I had a lot to do with in England in the 1980s and 1990s was a composer, Michael Nyman. And he had written scores for all the Peter Greenaway films. And I know you're familiar with Peter Greenaway, but it's a little bit of a cult film director. But many of his more bizarre movies like Prospero's Books and The Cook, the Wife, the Thief, and Her Lover.
Right.
He's certainly out there a little bit in the actual movies. But I love his music, and he's a perfect composer. You might call him in the minimalist style, although we used to jokingly refer to him as a maximalist because it was always, 80 miles per hour all the time. So he wrote some string quartets to try to get away from that sort of large, bombastic sound that he was renowned for. And he wrote three string quartets, and we recorded them some years ago. I've recorded them twice, in fact. But I wanted to play a little bit of his last quartet, one of the movements. I think it's the last movement of that as well, to sort of hear that Nyman sound.
I mean, he did incredible film scores. I thought one of the things I loved that he did was The Piano.
That's right. That's beautiful.
And that score for that movie was
absolutely
just unbelievable. He's still playing. He's still composing. He's still with us.
Oh, yes.
He's very much alive and working.
Absolutely. Michael's very very prolific. And the band, the Michael Nyman Band, which is his sort of voice, is still going very strong. And I miss playing with him. I played with him for 15 years and did the soundtrack for The Piano as well. That's very beautiful. In fact, I liked it so much. We did a suite of it, and I recorded the piano concerto, it was called, with the Royal Philharmonic about 10 years ago.
Well, we'll hear a bit of this, and this has been wonderful. So
thank you, Mark.
We'll close with this. I want to wish you a happy new year.
Yes, indeed. You too.
Your whole family.
Thank you.
And we have been joined by Jonathan Carney, concertmaster of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, bringing some of his holiday favorites. And we'll go out with little Nyman. And you can go to our website, steinershow.org, and see what we've played and take it home with you, maybe. Thank you so much. Good to see you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.